the operations of WWOR-TV from Secaucus into WNYW's facilities here in New York City, and they plan on cutting the technician workforce by about 20%, from 177 technicians to around 144. Merged and reduced news production, staff reductions, interstate job transfers, and changes in union representation are just some of the tangible results that Mavis CWA has seen rising from the Fox, New York, and Los Angeles duopolies. In addition, the residents of the state of New Jersey have been left without the commercial television station in their state that the commission sought to place in their community as part of a policy goal. While these changes may be more efficient, they do not advance the goals of diversity and localism. I'm going to skip ahead to my final concluding remarks since I'm out of time. In summary, it is imperative to retain the current local television ownership rule, as well as the dual network rule, the newspaper broadcast cross-ownership rule, and the radio ownership rule to protect and enhance media diversity, competition, and local community identity in order to promote the diverse, free, and vibrant media that is so essential to our democracy. Thank you.
James Joyce, Vice President of NABIT CWA.
John Mandel, MediaCom.
I think I'm going to have to do a poll track and talk fast. I hope the phone doesn't ring. You folks may be wondering, why would an advertising agency join with craft guilds such as DGA, SAG, and AFTRA that we're so often at odds with in an FCC filing? Well, we've come to a common realization of a problem. That is why we all formed the Coalition for Program Diversity. Our agency counterparts told us to just keep quiet because the media companies could hurt our business if we aggravate them. Well, as a professional, I'm too concerned about the future of the television industry. And I got to tell you, as a parent, I worry about the choices my daughter's going to have. Because my company is not impacted financially either way from the commission's actions, I have the freedom to speak from facts that justify our concern and can justify your actions. Our concern is not any single FCC regulation, but rather the confluence of regulatory moves. The deregulation and ownership of outlets combined with the deregulation of ownership of content production has created large problems for advertisers. Advertisers have seen their cost of network advertising rise much faster than inflation under the current scheme. This is important to the commission as advertising is the economic engine of free over-the-air television. As the FCC's OPP Paper 37 states, quote, broadcast television executives at companies which own two stations in a market believe that their companies gain greater influence with advertisers, end quote. When advertising costs go up, the price of the goods and services advertised go up for the American consumer. That will only get worse with further relaxation of the 35% cap. There's an even more troubling concern we have. That is that the current electronic marketplace has been shaped by the Commission's deregulation in such a way we are limited in our ability to reach the different audiences we need. It has become, as Working Group 5 study calls it, a bland landscape of primetime network television. Our goals are no different than the Commission's in making sure that there is diversity in media. Diverse programming attracts the diverse audiences that we need. This is particularly true in prime time. Prime time is prime because it is when the largest and most diverse number of people watch television. It is a unique and discrete programming marketplace. It cannot be lumped with other day parts as it delivers audience differently. As just one example, 15 years ago, a good number of working women watched daytime television. Today, working women are light viewers of daytime, but they're still watching prime time. To put some reality to the advertiser's need for diversity in primetime television, consider this. Last year, advertisers spent over $11 billion on network primetime. 682 different companies placed that advertising for 3,478 different brands. Poltrack says Madison Avenue wants, I say bull. Madison Avenue is 3,478 brands with 3,478 different potential customers, target audiences. And there are over 43 million Americans who do not have cable or satellite, and I want to be able to serve them. Let me also put some reality into how well this country's diverse tastes and interests are being met. I'm going to ignore the fact that the three major networks that combined were, let's just call it, disingenuous in every single one of their print outlet counts. In video, the networks feel they prove diversity exists because they count 472 video options in Washington. But they counted wrong and have proven the opposite. There are only 12 local over-the-air and 18 national cable discrete video voices in Washington. It only gets worse in small markets. The arithmetic when so few people control so many outlets is further exacerbated by the fact that the vast majority of network programming is in-house programming owned by their own production arms. The networks used to define best programming as the one that attracted the best audience. Now they define best programming as the one that is the best deal for them across all of their co-owned media outlets. Ted Harbert, a major network executive, says in Study 5, quote, Michael Eisner is saying, okay, ABC and Disney, everybody just get together in the same room and do it together. I think Disney shows will get on the air. That isn't going to mean that they're better, end quote. As Study 5 says, quote, now network executives need to keep these multiple aspects of vertical consolidation in mind when making the program selection. That's why there's so much so-called repurposing. When Fox runs 24 on air and network and then runs it twice in the same week on its cable networks, it is not increasing diversity. It is limiting it because that cable network now has 2 hours less to run different programs. The way to break this ever-decreasing program diversity is to adopt a content-neutral independent producer carve-out of at least 25% of network primetime schedules. With an independent carve-out, diversity will be promoted. The networks still keep 100% of the advertising revenue. Programming will be produced that will attract the many different audiences that advertisers need. Potential negative effects will be reduced on the consumer economy caused by increased advertising costs. It will ensure that even small advertisers will have access to primetime advertising, and it will ensure that all Americans, including the 43 million who rely on over-the-air television, have a wider landscape of programming to choose from. Our filing has more detail than it can do in 5 minutes about why it's necessary, how it's justified and sustainable by court decisions. Importantly, our documentation of diminished sources of diverse programs comes with footnotes you can check, and it comes from the FCC's own studies and working papers. We do not have to stretch to make arguments for the independent carve-out. The Commission's own work justifies it. Thank you.
John Mandel of MediaCom, New York. Final panelist on this business panel.
Wolzine.
Coming up, Tom Wolzine of Sanford Bernstein, a media analyst
for investment companies. Commissioners, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Tom Wolzine, and for the last 11 years, I've been the senior media analyst for Sanford C. Bernstein & Company. I provide research to large institutional investors, those are pension, mutual, and hedge funds, regarding publicly traded media companies, specifically AOL, Disney, and Viacom. I also provide them with industrial research regarding the intersections of content distribution and consumer electronics. I appear today at the request of the organizers. My approach will not be to advocate various regulatory positions, but rather to share some of the aspects of the current media landscape that I'm discussing with my institutional clients. First, to speak specifically of regulations, I must make a quick detour to abide by the new rules that cover analysts when they're making public appearances. Better believe it. you should know that while Bernstein does not do investment banking, it does manage money with its affiliates, and it holds a reportable position in Viacom. Personally, in the media sector, I own some shares of Comcast and a company called ACTV, and I'm a director of an ACTV subsidiary that deals with my patents that link media with on-screen services. ACTV is currently being acquired by Liberty Media. Thank you for your forbearance there. Hopefully I'm legal. In 1968, I began work as a news reporter and photographer at the Time Life station in Denver, for which AOL Time Warner will pay me a lump sum payment of $16 when I retire. It was a time back then when stations' licenses were up for review every 3 years, and we workers were constantly made aware of the fairness doctrine, of equal time, and of the need to enter any mention of any product mentioned in any program that was on the air in the station's supplementary log. It was an oligopoly, but even so, the words public interest, convenience, and necessity from the Communications Act were drummed into our heads by the station management. Many of us believed at that time, back in the late 60s and early 70s, that we operated in the public trust and used the valuable resources of the airwaves only with the public's permission. Now, 35 years later, broadcast network primetime audiences have fallen from nearly 60% of TV households to about 35 or 36% last season when all the broadcast, seven broadcast networks are counted. In some months, basic cable networks claim half the primetime viewers, The broadcast network viewership slide began around 1980 when cable hit 35% penetration. But something strange has been happening over the last couple of years. Even though the market share of network television has been dropping steadily, the revenues have generally been going up, with the broadcast television networks sharing nearly 70% of network advertising last year and the nearly 60 cable networks dividing the remainder. It might be said that the best thing that's happening to the broadcast networks is the fragmentation of the cable nets, but that in itself will likely result in even more consolidation of the cable network business. As an equities analyst, I'm interested in the total earnings of a company and its divisions, not just the earnings of one individual service, one broadcast network, one broadcast station, one cable network. But in the end, it's the performance of an individual stock that's based much more on the aggregation of revenues, the costs, and the delivery of free cash flow across the entire company, rather than the standalone performance of one unit, so long as that one unit's performance is not so abysmal as to tank the whole company. Reference AOL's online operation. Over the last few years, we've been tracking Nielsen data to learn how broadcast and cable networks are doing alone, but also when aggregated by the individual, by a single owner. And by the end of last summer, a small group of five media companies, AOL, Time Warner, Disney, News Corp, Fox, GE's NBC, and Viacom, controlled about 75% of the primetime viewing in English language, the commercial viewing, when broadcast and cable networks viewing are combined. Viacom led this group with about 21%, followed by Disney with about 17%, AOL with 14%, and the others. Of course, all three companies also gain additional audiences from their non-ad-supported premium pay services with higher subscriber fees. One other area of change that's of great interest is the potential for the rise of local cable systems to sell local advertising now in force. With the consolidation of the cable industry on both the local and national levels, for the first time, major cable companies are positioning themselves to take ad growth away from local television stations. For example, Comcast is now the primary provider of cable service in 17 of the top 20 markets and has recently established a national spot advertising operation here in New York City. Through the Television Bureau of Advertising, broadcasters are now mounting an offensive to counter cable advertising. But assuming cable is able to take advantage of its national and local consolidation, I suspect that we'll see the marginalization of some television stations, those stations that do not clearly differentiate local news and service to the community and instead look like sort of cable operations but using the broadcast airwaves. Now, what about mergers in total? In a Bernstein study last year called those murderous mergers of media, we found that except for the very balanced merger of Viacom and CBS with roughly a similar exchange rate, the huge recent mergers had produced horrible results for shareholders. What did work, however, were those mergers or acquisitions where companies acquired known businesses in a relatively, the operative word is relatively, small acquisitions, and they were reasonably priced. These sort of tuck-in deals, call them, of companies to fill out existing business lines and expand on the periphery without betting the whole company in the deal. After the last few years, it may be some time before there are any more transformational deals. But at minimum, the volume of these tuck-in deals will be the manifestation of the deregulatory approaches taken by the Commission. Thank you very much.
Tom Wolzien, media analyst for Sanford Bernstein & Company. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's continuing live coverage of the Forum on Media Ownership from Columbia University Law School. There will now be questions from the audience taken by the moderator and then a closing statement by June Besick, who is executive director of the Kernikan Center for Law, Media, and the Arts at Columbia.
Why is the ownership of local affiliates the answer to network revenue problems? Why not renegotiate the relationship between networks and their affiliates? Why are networks paying affiliates to run programming? Well, Marty, you can bring up the date a little bit, but talk about that a little bit.
Careful, Harry. You're going to be accused of giving me a softball. In fact, that's exactly what we have been doing. When Mr. Paley started CBS as a radio network to advertise cigars, what he did was he went out and persuaded radio stations, in essence, to sell to him or lease to him their time, and he aggregated a national audience in which to sell advertising. That radio model translated over into television, and so for years and years, television networks paid local stations to run our programs into which we could insert our ads. In 1991, CBS began a fairly aggressive program of trying to reduce that very so-called compensation. It led to an interesting development in 1994 when the then fourth network that no one thought could ever arise or succeed took away from us our NFC football contract, and shortly thereafter, the New World stations, owned by Ron Perlman in those days, defected from CBS, in partly over the compensation issue and also because they wanted to run football. And CBS had to scurry around for the next 2 years. I accumulated many frequent flyer miles lining up replacement stations. Dennis alluded to our biggest problem. I mean, I could make an argument we still haven't fully recovered from that. In Detroit, we're on Channel 62, a station that still has technical flaws. It used to be WGPR, Where God's Power Reigns. It was one of the first religious stations in America when we bought it. There are any number of people in the Detroit market who do not know that CBS is on the air in Detroit. It goes to this point. It's interesting, therefore, that someone would suggest, why do we need to own more stations? We need to own more stations either to be able... On the one hand, the affiliates say... Let me try and straighten this out. My syntax is lacking. The affiliates say that they need help or we will dominate them. You know, poor, struggling mom-and-pop companies like the New York Times and the Washington Post need protection from CBS. It is mind-boggling to me that is the notion. It is a free market exchange. We lost an affiliate in Jacksonville this year that had been a CBS affiliate for 40 years because we couldn't come to terms on them carrying our programming. That's okay. But somehow this notion that Cox is going to be better at running a local television station than we are, there's nothing empirically in the record to suggest that that is true.
But Marty, why is it so important? If you ran the network business, and if you ran it better, you wouldn't need...
Our affiliates have made that argument to us, too. The national... Tom just made the point, so far... In the national marketplace, not only do we compete with the other networks, we compete with national cable channels. That local marketplace has not yet developed as competitively because cable hasn't done a very good job of figuring out how to sell local advertising. When cable figures out how to sell local advertising, and we are real close to that happening, then that local marketplace is not going to be as attractive either. But all of the programming investment occurs at the national level. And if we don't have some better way of, we kind of break even on our NFL rights at the network level, and we make whatever money we're going to make at the station level. If we don't make that station money, we can't afford the network rights. And that's why NBC has chosen to get out of a whole range of the sports business. They can't make money doing it. And what baseball used to be, I mean, the playoffs in baseball used to be exclusively on free television. The World Series is now on free television, but much of the play of the earlier rounds of the playoffs leading up to it are not available in 30 to 40% of the households in America because they're on cable. Now, that may not be un-American, but it is a public policy issue that more people ought to be concerned about.
For a second, Marty. I don't disagree with you on everything, but I do think that we should make sure that the numbers are right. Let's not forget that Report 37 from the FCC points out that you guys are now, in 4 years, you have dropped the percentage of net advertising revenues you spend on programming by 15%, down to 26%. My costs have gone up for primetime advertising, for instance, by 42% in that same time period. I don't quite understand how you lowered your cost 15% according to your own numbers and raised my price by 42% and you say you're not making money.
Well, John, I guess I have a question. Why, your industry responded appropriately and fully consistent with the laws of the United States of America by having an unprecedented consolidation into a smaller and smaller group so that you could leverage us back and compete effectively against
you. I will go back to report number 37, which points out that the larger agencies ended up paying higher prices because, quote-unquote, your ability to make a deal is commensurate with your ability to walk from it. I would point out that if you and I, we're still speaking after this, I'll still speak to you. I don't know about poll track, and I don't know if you'll speak to me. But if we're still speaking tomorrow, we can get some money from Wolsey, and then we can start another buying service. Peter Knobloch recently did it. But if you and I go out to Radio Shack and buy a bunch of stuff and start broadcasting, we'll get our butts thrown in jail because of the public airways. We are not a closed industry. Anybody can do it. So that argument about we're too big is bullshit.
Tom?
First of all, Bernstein doesn't do banking. Sorry.
Oh, damn.
We're talking like broadcast stations are really still broadcast stations as opposed predominantly backhaul mechanisms to the cable head end. According to the Nielsen numbers that are being used this year for 106.7 million television households, according to Nielsen, 83% of those households are receiving multi-channel service from one source of satellite cable or something else.
On at least one set.
But let's talk about what's going to the household. In a least that they are paying money, in only 17% of the households are not paying money. There are a lot of questions about that 17% and the necessity to serve all socioeconomic groups of the country and the people that may not elect to pay broadcast and free over there. But the fact of the matter is that what this argument is actually over, to a cent of 83%, is how the public airwaves are being used as backhaul. And I think that we should keep that in mind.
Well, excuse me, just one second. On 9/11, I mean, there were 2 million homes in the New York Metro that were able to get one source of television. By the accident of fate of CBS having failed to cancel its lease on its backup transmitter at the Empire State Building. I don't want to say that, you know, we're a paragon of virtue, but for several weeks, the only source that 2 million relatively, I suspect, highly disadvantaged individuals in the New York Metro had was they had access to WCBS over the air. I don't think we ought to tread too lightly, if we're talking about the public interest, after all, about, you know, whether it's backhauls or not.
It was CBS that initiated the concept of retransmission consent and then failed to convert retransmission consent to actually being paid for the product. And then subsequently, it was ABC and NBC and Fox that were able to convert retransmission consent into new cable operations, many of those that we were talking about before in the totals, and CBS was unable to do that. There were corporate decisions that really put CBS in the position, pre-Viacom, that put CBS in the position of being, in essence, a standalone broadcaster and ultimately causing it to merge with Viacom and now having access to the Viacom cable operations. But I think that there is clearly a public interest need to maintain over-the-air broadcasting, but I also think it's necessary to recognize just how the physical distribution in this country is currently occurring.
Let's talk a little radio here with Michelle. You talked about Clear Channel and Infinity. That's history, isn't it? I mean, you can't do anything about that now. Or would you recommend that we do try to take some of these things apart at this point?
I would recommend that the industry be re-regulated, that it would be broken up to provide the diversity that's needed. Now, there's three things that the FCC is mandated to do: protect localism, promote competition, and ensure diversity. Deregulation in radio had the exact opposite effect.
I'm not suggesting that your position isn't perfectly valid from an intellectual argument. You're just in the wrong venue. I mean, that is not what is before us today.
No, it's not. But the fact that radio was the incubator test for deregulation, it's the industry that we can look at for the further deregulation of our airwaves and our broadcast. If you create cross-media ownership across television, radio, newspaper. Essentially what you will get is feudal lords in markets where your entire voice is from one company. You know, there's nothing wrong with Viacom or Clear Channel or any other corporation serving their shareholders. But the fact of the matter is, it is in direct opposition to what should be held in the public interest. There's a huge conflict there.
Here's a question. You can try to answer it, for John and Marty, I guess. Do you have any specific comment or experience on the effects of both all news radio stations, New York City market being owned by Viacom? Seems to me that can't be such a good idea. John? Well, let John take a crack at it.
Let me give you an example that Dennis, who I think is the greatest broadcaster ever put on the face of the earth, and frankly, if he ran every station, I'd have a different opinion. He glossed over it today. Somehow in the filings, they talked about how much more news networks are doing. Dennis owned up to that in Detroit they got a problem, so they cut back on their news. But let me point out, before that, there was a 10 o'clock news, and this affects local advertisers, smaller advertisers that are not national. Late news is one of the great places to advertise because, you know, people are working, they come home, you can reach them. Originally, WWJ, the CBS station news, was produced by the UPN station. Okay? So already you've got one less voice, when they said there wouldn't be one less voice. They then closed the UPN news department, canceled the CBS news department, and the UPN's news is now programmed by ABC. So they were sort of deregulated in Detroit, and rather than add news, they had one news run on two places, and then they said, well, we're still not making enough money, so we'll get rid of it and have our competitor ABC. So now ABC's on a bunch of stations. I don't see why the radio deregulation, that to me, that case alone proves that the same thing's going to happen in television, and the local advertiser's going to get screwed.
Let's think.
And viewer. Sorry, but I got to think of my first customer.
I would like to think of that. In the radio industry, news directors are a fading breed. Where in a typical newsroom, news department and radio station, back in 94, it had 4.5 people to every news organization. That has shrunk so that today it's about 1.6. If you use this market as an example, both WINS and WCBS are owned by the same organization. And the amount of soft news, lifestyle news, has increased, and that's true across the board. You know, it's turned into blather as opposed to hard news and knowing the fact. And the Bill of Rights protects the freedom of the press. And you can't say that with what's happened in radio that we have that. It's no longer false that we have freedom of the press because it's completely controlled by two organizations.
Michelle, can you fairly say that about the two Viacom news stations here in town? It's short, it's brief, it's a cycle, but it's hard news. Tells us when we're
there. Listen, there's many more lifestyle features on both radio stations.
I have a question for Mr. Joyce.
Can I try and answer the question you asked?
Okay,
the
question, right?
Never mind.
If we were the big, bad media conglomerate seeking only economic return, when we came to control both news stations, then, in theory, we should have shut one of them down and eliminated. Well,
why would you? Don't, please.
Speaker is Martin Franks of CBS Viacom, who is being challenged by a member of the audience. His remarks we can't quite make out. Several members of the audience, in fact.
Different.
Come on, please. You know, we're doing it by cards here, and I don't want to get into Marty, finish up.
Well, I'm guilty until I'm proven innocent, so I'm not sure it's even worth the breath. I'll pass.
Well, okay.
It's not worth it, Harry.
Tom, you were shaking your head on that.
In New York, there are two stations that are specifically going toward two broad demographic groups. And these two stations are designed and in their presentation to try to maximize the audience within the demographic areas that they're going for. It made business sense for the company to have it in this market. They kept them going. I don't know the circumstances in Chicago, but when you look at it, when you look at whether a station is run or whether a company is running multiple stations dealing basically the same format, they're trying to maximize their revenues for the shareholders. And Harry, I'd like to just point.
But we're doing it by trying to serve a broader audience.
That's what I said. Harry, I have one thing, and I'd like to do this because I'd like to just sort of illustrate the problem that the company representatives have here, and that is that I'd like, by a show of hands, everybody who you, your spouse, or your parents have a pension or mutual fund, are going to get money from somebody sometime, have stock, have annuities, variable annuities, anything like that. Is there anybody here that doesn't have anything like that? Are there many people that don't have that? I'd like to see how many. Are there many people that don't? A few. Okay. Now, for those that didn't raise your hands and do, I would like to ask you the question of, do you like to see your funds make less than the guy next door across the street or whatever? Anybody that likes to see that, raise your hands. All right. You are all conflicted with the company people here in terms of maximizing the returns on the investment for your own benefits, because the bulk of the money in this country that's invested in these companies is invested in institutional investors and pension and mutual funds, including the CWA pension fund and others. So finding a balance between the immediate public good and the immediate needs of the companies to maximize their earnings, so to benefit most of the people in this room, is really the struggle that we're all involved with here.
Wait a minute. Roger King owns more stock in Viacom than Mel does, I believe. And if you go to Electronic Media Magazine this week, in January 6th issue, sorry, Harry, it's another magazine, Dick Robertson talks about how shows are being renewed that would never even have a scintilla of a chance if not for the vertically integrated. And Roger agrees with him. I don't disagree with that at all. I agree 100%. Roger then goes on to talk about how this vertical integration has actually hurt them. So what I'm proposing of not letting this deregulation go, you may actually save these guys from themselves, according to Roger King, one of the largest stockholders in CBS.
Disney has already discovered that vertical integration, strictly formed, is a disaster, as we've seen with the ABC television network. And isn't it interesting that this year they contracted with HBO to develop additional shows for the network?
I do have a question for Mr. Joyson. Isn't technology your real enemy and not consolidation? I mean, the fact that you can operate, you know, several stations out of Baltimore, and you can do news for all your stations out of one location, or you can easily operate two stations in a market from one location, isn't that your real enemy? I mean, not what the FCC might or might not do.
This is James Joyce of NABIT.
Employers who try to use new technology as an excuse to shift work away from people that we represent. In a lot of cases, there is work that still has to be performed by individuals, but they tend to try to move that work away from collective bargaining agreements. We see that with Lynn Broadcasting, who is now trying to hub its Buffalo operation out of Indianapolis. And we believe primarily that's due to the fact that they have a collective bargaining agreement in Buffalo and they don't in Indianapolis. We believe that we're the union for the technology age. We try to actively train our members, both in broadcasting and other telecommunication venues, to be on top of the technology. But in a lot of cases, we see employers trying to use that as an excuse.
It's really not something the FCC can fix for you or remedy.
Well, the FCC, I guess, has to, in looking at the overall ownership rules, delicately balance, I guess, what employers claim are attempts to strive at efficiency and what the other goal was, and that is to promote diversity. A number of us, I'm a longtime ABC employee. I've been there since the early 1980s. I've seen two major ownership changes from ABC to Cap Cities, now to Disney. Of course, I want to see the company do well, but as the collective bargaining representative, I want to make sure that either years of bargaining gains, conditions that we've negotiated for over decades just aren't immediately wiped out, or that our employees who have contributed to the success of the company continue to receive some premium from that.
I'm sorry we didn't get into the FinCEN. I'm going to invite June up here to wrap things up.
June is June Besick, Executive Director of the Kernikan Center.
I'm June Besick.
For Law, Media, and the Arts.
Of the Kernikan Center for Law, Media, and the Arts, the host for this forum. As we close, I want to remind you that today's proceedings were webcast and recorded. If you want to refer to them again in the future, they'll be available soon through the Columbia Law School's website, which is www.law.columbia.edu. This is particularly useful for those of you who, like me, won't necessarily have complete recall of everything that's been said today. I want to thank our distinguished guests, Congressman Nadler, who was here this morning, and the FCC commissioners and their staff for joining us today, and a particular thank you to those of you with the patience and stamina to remain with us all day and listen so patiently to all the comments that have been made. I also want to thank all of the panelists from this morning and this afternoon for coming here today and sharing their views with us. I want to thank our moderator, Harry Jessel, who moved things along so smoothly and efficiently. And I want to thank the audience for your patient attention and your excellent questions. And I'm only sorry that we couldn't get to all of them, but time simply did not permit. And finally, I want to thank all of our staff who helped to organize and run this event. Thank you all, and good afternoon.
And that is the director of the Kernikan Center of the Columbia Law School wrapping up a full day's hearings and testimony from members of the Federal Communications Commission and various aspects of the broadcast industry and interests. You're listening to Pacifica Radio. My name is Robert Knight in New York with Larry Binsky in Berkeley, California. And Pacifica is a network with exquisitely credible programs and incredibly good shows such as our flagship Democracy Now!, Peace Watch, Imperatives for Peace, Free Speech Radio News, and Flashpoints, which comes out of KPFA, which along with KPFK, KPFT, WBAI, and WPFW in Washington, comprise the Pacifica Network, which you can support because of its independence and non-dependence on corporate deep pockets. We need your help to be able to do special events like this, and if you go to the website, pacifica.org, you can learn more about all of these things and, more importantly, preserve our ability to defy the commercial tendencies of broadcast today. This is non-commercial Pacifica Radio, which broadcasts in the public interest, serving the listeners rather than serving the listeners up to advertisers.
Thank you, Robert. www.pacifica.org. We have more to come here. We have some guests who are going to comment on issues that were and weren't discussed. Robert and I will be here for another hour or so. We're also going to open our phones again for more listener phone-ins, as we did briefly during the lunch break. But to begin, we're going to hear some highlights of the people who spoke this morning, and some of you may have not have been awake here on the West Coast or listening, or perhaps not listening all day long. We've been at it since 9 o'clock this morning, East Coast, and 6 in the morning out here in California. Two very different things, I think, Robert, were being discussed here today. It may have led to some of the confusion in how people were reacting to each other on the panels and some of the questions that were coming to the panelists. Broadcasting was being discussed both as a public trust and as a business. And there's been, ever since the beginning of broadcasting in this country, a tension and a contradiction between the two. Robert McChesney, who was one of the panelists, but was also our guest, and Robert and I were here at the beginning of the program many hours ago, pointed out that he's the foremost scholar of this in the United States at the University of Illinois. He pointed out how this contradiction has existed forever, dating back to the 1920s and 30s when the first legislation was proposed and passed to try to figure out who would have what frequencies and what would, in fact, go on a limited scarcity resource like the broadcast spectrum of the United States at that time, radio, and later, of course, television, and then other technologies, telephone, internet, etc. For some people here today, clearly it was a question of maximizing profits. One of the speakers on the last panel talked about how, well, if you're in the audience and you want to make a lot of money, you'll do things our way and you won't be against consolidation because we can make you more money on your 401ks or your investments or whatever. But for other people who spoke today earlier, what they are doing and what they have been doing in broadcasting, in journalism broadcasting, and even in entertainment broadcasting, is something entirely different. Take journalism, for example. Here is a brief excerpt of the remarks of Juan Gonzalez, who is president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, columnist for the New York Daily News, and, of course, a longtime co-host of Democracy Now! As well.
You see, for many of us, journalism is not just some consumer product like cornflakes or cars. At its best, it is a noble profession and a public service. It helps to right wrongs. It gives strength to the powerless. It informs and enlightens readers, viewers, and listeners about events outside their direct experience. But at its worst, journalism becomes the bait for the commercials. It distorts reality, inflames passions, reinforces stereotypes, marginalizes dissenting views, and functions as a mouthpiece for the powerful. No one is more aware than us how technology is fundamentally changing the way news and information is delivered, or how the rise of media conglomerates has radically altered the priorities of many news organizations.
Juan Gonzalez. Robert Knight, that was as eloquent a statement as we were going to get today about one way to approach the broadcasting spectrum, but it certainly wasn't the only way that speakers today in this media forum were talking about the broadcasting spectrum.
Among the things they spoke about, of course, is the concentration of ownership. And I think there's a very emblematic situation that was represented in the event today, and that is the co-presence of the FCC and the vice president in television for Fox. And I think it bears re-noting that although Commissioner Powell said that it will be the future deregulation that's the result of courts, that's a result of Congress, and that it will be based on empirical studies rather than vaporous concepts such as serving the public interest. On July of 2001, the Federal Communications Commission elided or failed to enforce a rule capping an owner at 35% of the national audience, television audience, when it allowed Fox to acquire Chris Kraft and 10 television stations, among them in Los Angeles, New York, and other major cities, and taking up 41% of the audience. I'd like to just read a sentence from the FCC's own official news release on the reasoning behind that, saying, quote, "However, since the 35% national ownership cap is currently the subject of review in the D.C. Circuit Court, the commission said it would delay the effectiveness of this part of the order pending final disposition of the court case." Now, the FCC also allowed Fox to own two media outlets in one city, here in New York, where it also owns the New York Post. That is also a violation of the rules that had been in existence. And there, the commission gave Fox 2 years to relinquish one of the two television stations. However, that means that Fox has until July of 2003, and if these regulations are removed by then, Fox will have benefited from the unique position of being grandfathered in, or grandmothered in, to two stations and a newspaper in a major city. So it appears that the FCC has been deregulatory well before any requirement for empirical justification.
A good point, and it's also, I think, important to notice that Fox is just not nobody. Fox is the most politicized broadcast network that has ever existed in this country. You know, people talk about Pacifica. Pacifica is a model of balance and rectitude compared to Fox, which has an overt agenda of promoting Republicans and the Bush administration on things like Fox News Network, rigorously censors off anybody who might dissent against such things as attacking Iraq, and basically has served as a shill for the Republican Party. These are the people who've been allowed to take over the airwaves, consolidate, as you say, with newspapers, make a bundle of money, and also influence in a way that would have been unthinkable in the 35-year-old scenario that one of the final speakers were talking about, when we had the Fairness Doctrine, when we had the Equal Time Rule, when we had ascertainment for whether radio stations were fulfilling their commitment to the community. All of those things have gone out in the wash, and what's come in is a very aggressive, in-your-face, conservative, politicized network, Fox, which is allowed to use the airwaves for political purposes, demagoguery, if you will, or at least propaganda, if you think that's a nicer word, and also make out like bandits and make a lot of money while doing so.
In addition, there's another environmental factor in the accumulation of ownership, and that is the political environment in which the industries themselves are making major donations. For instance, even in the off-year 2002 election cycle, according to the Center for Responsive Politics, the television and film and recording industry contributed $44 million to political candidates just in the off-year elections alone, and the telecommunications industry contributed $13 million. These are certainly significant inducements for legislators who, for instance, in 1996, enacted the Telecommunications Act that led us on the slippery slope of deregulation.
We mentioned Robert McChesney, the professor at the University of Illinois, who we interviewed you and I before the program began, Robert, and he also testified on one of the panels. He summed up what he thought these proceedings today were about or should have been about. Let's listen to him.
So I'll close with just a few of the issues that demand very detailed, rigorous study before any deregulation should be done. First, journalism. As Ms. Mitchell talked about, there's a real crisis in journalism. Increasingly, there's evidence of what's good for these companies, what makes the most money, does not produce the best journalism. If we allow companies to conglomerate, known television, radio, cable companies within a community, there's a real concern you'll have one newsroom in these communities. And the real concern, there'll be a real lack of localism in these communities, lack of local journalism. Already a crisis, but it'll just get that much worse. There'll be much less coverage, if that's possible, of candidates in elections in our free media. Reduction where candidates basically get into bidding wars on political advertising. Also, this concentration, we have to examine how much we will accelerate the hyper-commercialism, which is evident across our media culture. The increase in the total amount of advertising, but even more ominously, the increase in the deterioration of the border between advertising and the editorially creative part of our media. That's a real issue, especially with children, but in our journalism and across our culture. This has to be studied. We have to expect what will happen with conglomeration and concentration if we don't examine these issues. And then finally, my last point is the Internet. Invariably, the arguments for deregulation come down to the point the Internet changes everything. It sets us free. It introduces thousands and thousands of voices. We need real examination of exactly how the Internet's going to work this magical way. So far, there have been no commercially successful content providers generated by the Internet after 10 years. So it hasn't been provided a commercial alternative yet. To the extent it's been commercial, it's been incorporated by the largest companies. Likewise, to the extent the Internet does develop commercially, there's no evidence that it develops locally. And since so many of these deregulations will affect local communities and local markets, lead to concentration there, there's no reason to expect the Internet will solve that problem for us. I'd submit these are questions that need to be examined, and no credible public service can be done until it gets serious, slow, detailed examination and debate. Thank you.
Well, it's possible that today's forum is one of the opening shots in that serious, slow debate. The FCC has scheduled a formal hearing, and today's was not an FCC hearing. It was an independent panel, a series of panels put on by Columbia University Law School, Robert Knight. But the FCC is having a hearing in Richmond, Virginia at an unnamed date yet in February, at which we will be expected to see some concrete proposals perhaps on the table that can be debated.
Yes, and one of the things that I guess is a truism in the industry is that advertisers believe that children are the future of their profitability. And Larry Binsky, we are now joined by Patty Miller, who is with the organization Children Now, where she is the executive director of the Children and Media Program. And we'd like to ask you, Patty Miller, how are children affected by the trends in broadcast and communications today?
Thanks so much for having me on the show. There's no question that children are going to be negatively impacted if the FCC decides to modify or eliminate media ownership rules.
Well, one of the issues that we're confronting right now is the transmission of cell phone information. Your signal is cracking up. Are you in a stable position?
You know, I am in a stable position, but I'm hearing some kind of echo.
Yeah. Yes, your signal is not coming through clearly. I think we should come back to you and recontact you and hope that we get a better channel of communication. So would you please stand by, Patty Miller?
Robert,
thank
let's,
you.
Let's try to do it from out
Larry?
Here. Let's try to call her from out here. Maybe we'll be able to get a landline on Stephanie Hendricks.
But among the issues to be addressed is the way that broadcasts insinuate products like non-nutritious food and toys that are surrounded by a syndrome or a concept of violence, as well as the rechanneling of broadcasts into children's venues in order to create a familiarity that ultimately pays off in recognition and brand familiarity and future purchases.
We had another issue today that kind of got sloshed around and glossed over, Robert Knight, and that is the question of whether or not further media consolidation would lead to a diminution of voices, especially voices that don't get on radio and television, even now as it is. One of the panelists on an early panel today was James Winston, who's executive director and general counsel of the National Association of Black-Owned Broadcasters. And in case people wondered, what is he talking about, black-owned broadcasters, he said that there are now only 240 African-American-owned radio stations in the United States out of some 13,000 stations, and that this number has been diminishing as offers people can't refuse are being made for frequencies all over the country. When somebody asked him a question, well, what difference does it make anyway? You know, if we buy your station, we may do better news than you, in fact, do. This was his response.
Media companies of every stripe put news on the air. The question is, who decides what is news? Who's going to be the news director? Who's going to be the assignment editor? Who's going to decide what gets covered? Those things have to start at the top. It all starts from the top and goes down. The principal questions here are, who's going to decide who gets what news? Who's going to decide what programming gets on the air, whether it's public affairs or entertainment programming? Who is going to decide? If minorities are not making any of those decisions, the American public as a whole will lose out. Thank you.
And in response to that, one of the people who was representing the corporation said that, well, you know, when Black Entertainment Television, BET, became really successful, it got brought up by Viacom. This is an example of success. What was glossed over was the fact that after Viacom bought BET, they gutted all the news and public affairs programs and got rid of their hosts and made it into a wall-to-wall money-making music video service, pretty much. So the point of view of whether or not getting more money represents success, or whether or not preserving an outlet for people to speak and say things represents success, was another one of the underlying issues that mostly got glossed over today, I would think. All right.
Diversity and ownership also succumbs to other issues that are intermingled with it. Among them, issues that are used to be traditional goals of FCC regulation, issues such as localism and community access. One suspects that if there were more community than corporate input into a network like BET, that the programming would be as sophisticated as the African community, African-American community. And it is, I think, a clear statement on the inefficacy of the profit model in broadcast that only 1 in 50 of radio outlets in the United States are of people of color, which is a tremendously small underrepresentation of the actual population.
I believe we have
similar effects, I think, would occur for Native American and Latino broadcasts as well, although the popularity of Latino broadcasts is increasing exponentially in urban centers.
I believe we have Patty Miller back on the line here. Let's see if we have a better connection. Hello, Patty Miller, are you there?
I am here. Thanks so much.
Sounds much better. Robert Knight, why don't you pick it up where you left off?
Well, as the director of the Children and Media Project at Children Now, what is your reaction to the tendencies in broadcast and media ownership and communications today?
Well, we think it's very troubling. I think consolidation is going to have very negative impacts on the child audience in several different areas. Primarily, consolidation is going to reduce the amount of original programming for kids. Right now, we're seeing programming being shared by broadcast and cable partners. And as consolidation continues, we're going to see more of that, reducing the amount of original programming for kids. We're also concerned that increased consolidation is going to result in more commercialism, which parents are very concerned about, and it's already there's so much commercialism in media, and even though there's limits on the amount of commercials in kids' TV, as consolidation occurs, there's going to be cross-marketing, more in-program, commercial placement. All of these things will have a very negative impact on the child audience.
For children, commercials, I suspect, are hypnotically effective or magically delicious. And there are two ways that children can be influenced by broadcasts and what they consume from the media, and that is the explicit commercials. But I'm wondering if you're aware of any extent to which commercialism or product placement or anything like that occurs within the content of programs themselves that are designed for children.
Well, you know, we're starting to see that across television programming right now, specifically with technologies like TiVo. Advertisers are very concerned that no one is going to be watching the advertising between programming, so they're starting to put more products in the actual shows. There aren't any studies right now that document that going on in kids' television, but I'm pretty certain that that would start to take place. In a consolidated environment, also cross-marketing, product merchandising, program-length commercials. These are all things we have to be concerned about in a consolidated media environment.
Are there any encouraging broadcasts or products that children could be watching that would counter the deleterious effect of commercialism?
I'm sorry, are there any programs?
Are there any good programs that counter commercialism?
Well, I mean, I think we want to make sure that kids have access to educational programming that teaches them lessons about civic engagement, that are pro-social, that actually teach kids the ABCs and other educational information. But I think commercialism is so rampant across programming, and clearly broadcasters, main goal is to make a profit, so we're going to see more and more commercialism in a consolidated environment, having a very negative impact on kids. I mean, there are numerous studies that show the negative effects of commercialism on kids, unhealthy eating habits, irresponsible attitudes about drugs and alcohol, increases in parent-child conflicts. So what kids don't need is more commercial influence.
What do you make of the Disney radio? I'm sorry, Robert. I just wanted to ask that. What do you make of the Disney radio network? Have you monitored that very much? Because they do have quite a few radio stations. I don't know how many all across the United States, including here in Northern California, on a frequency that was once the voice of the African American community, KDIA, 1310 AM is Disney radio. What do you make of what's being broadcast there?
I mean, I think, once again, this is an example of kids getting Disney programming, across the board over and over again, and reducing the diversity available for young listeners and young viewers. We know kids consume an inordinate amount of media, almost 3 hours a day of television alone, and over 65% of kids have television sets in their bedrooms.
That's an appalling statistic.
It is an appalling statistic. The FCC is trying to claim that, the Internet is going to serve as a substitute, we have more diversity for kids today, but I think that's just not the case. I mean, 25% of kids in this country don't have access to cable, and so it's really important that we ensure that there's diversity of owners, so there's diversity of programming and diversity of viewpoint. I mean, we're extremely disappointed as well. The FCC has not addressed kids' needs at all in this proceeding. I think today in the hearing, it's the first time you actually heard kids' issues being mentioned by Katina Perrin, which was terrific. We're really disappointed that in a 60-some-odd page notice of proposed rulemaking, the FCC failed to consider the impact of proposed changes on children. And clearly, the history of children's television demonstrates that kids lose out when the marketplace alone determines programming.
Well, another influence on children's programming is maybe a mixed blessing or a good one or not. And here I'm referring to Congress and legislation. Childism is often used as a reason for the passage of various laws. We have the Children's Television Act and other kinds of things. Would you say that the impact of recent legislation has been as effective and beneficial as intended? How would you characterize the legislative approach to children's education through the media?
Mm-hmm. Well, children's television is the principal area of programming where Congress has determined that special oversight is necessary. And there have been strict rules on advertising during children's programming and mandating that broadcasters air 3 hours a week of educational informational programs per week. But I think that the FCC hasn't done a good enough job in terms of making sure that